This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We thought this was an opportune day to check in with Michigan writer Thomas Lynch. A longtime funeral director for Lynch & Sons, now mostly retired, and a lauded poet, he's had some things to say about the pandemic year. And we heard he has a new collection of poetry, essays, and more publishing today under the title Bone Rosary. And he writes in the introduction, "Never in my life did the sky seem to be falling from all four corners as it seems to now. Pandemic, racial injustice, economic collapse, climate change. Nor has the body politic, the culture at large, ever seemed so in cahoots as a comorbidity." Thomas Lynch, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thanks, April. Nice to be here.
Hey, the last time we talked to you, you were sort of hiding out from COVID at a family property up north. Is that where you are right now?
Yes, I haven't stirred from here much at all. So, yeah, it's a gilded quarantine, but quarantine nonetheless. So,
well, we're glad to hear you're keeping safe. Also, since the last time we talked, you lost your daughter, Heather.
Yeah, Heather died last July the 2nd.
We are so sorry to hear about this.
Thank you for your fellow feelings and condolences. We're just doing a day at a time. My family, Heather's mother, Heather's stepmother, Heather's brothers, and me. And, I can only report my own. I mean, I'm still upright in speaking in sentences, which I count as a real gift, that I haven't been sort of entirely leveled, you know?
Yeah. I think still upright is maybe the most any of us are hoping for in this moment. Heather seems like she had a pretty amazing life. Do you mind telling us a little bit about her?
No, I love to speak about her. She was my only daughter. She was, I think, she had a huge native intelligence, which she pursued through education and experience and the rest. But she was beset, as so many people are, by a malaise that we would call, depression or schizophrenia, which developmentally began to show itself more and more in her adult life. There were inklings of it early in her life, but in all ways, she was beset by this because she had such energy and such commitment to a lot of different causes, and we all learned a lot from her. And but this illness pursued her all of her life, and in the end, it took her from us, and she died by suicide. And in the same way that if I drop dead, as I expect to someday, of a final fatal symptom, it will be of the heart disease or misadventures of related to, my well-being. In the same way, I suppose that suicide is the final fatal symptom of an illness that included a nearly 15-year estrangement from her family of origin. And that was hard on all of us. And it seems odd to say now, April, but it, in some ways, it sort of readied us for the horrific death by suicide that we all suffered.
Thomas, it's really hard for some families to speak publicly about deaths by suicide. Why was it important to you to tell people about the manner of her death?
I don't know that it was. I never felt like an urgency, but I just never felt like I'm fairly concerned about privacy issues, but I'm not as fond of secrecy issues. I think they work against our our better purposes and our best instincts. So I do know that in 50 years as a funeral director, the thing I feared the most was to walk into a room to sit down with parents who I now feel a closer, hard-won kinship with. And the reason I feared it, because I didn't know what to say. No one ever does. And yet I find that if I broached the topic, she had many friends. She had dozens of cousins who loved her dearly and learned from her. And I find that if I signal that this is not a taboo topic for me, it allows so much good remembrance of this beautiful jewel of a human being that we had the good luck to know, not as long as we would have wished to, but longer than many do. So I think the fright that most of us feel around the newly bereaved, and in particular the newly bereaved by suicide, is that we don't know exactly what to say, and we're afraid that any mention of the dead, and this is true regardless of the cause of death, we think by talking about the dead, we are somehow encumbering the bereaved. I find just the opposite, that any conversation about the dead, my daughter, my parents, my neighbors in Clare who died between Christmas and the Epiphany, I'd say that the catalog of losses for most people, certainly people who get to be old farts like me, that catalog is ongoing. And so talk about the dead is by allowing them to have a conversation, it's a kindness to them. So we're always afraid that we might remind the bereaved of the death in the family, as if they could ever forget it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's front of mind for most people who carry these sadnesses with them. Most of our hearts are broken in one way or the other. And the courage that ordinary people display by being upright and talking in sentences, or going to work, or taking care of the babies, or feeding the hungry, or, you know, voting in the primary election, whatever it is, we keep telling ourselves that life goes on, which is, as anyone who has ever suffered a death in the family knows, the good news and the bad news, but it is the news. Life does go on. The world persists with or without us. But my daughter, I remember on her birthday this year, which was the 1st of March, there was this sudden recognition that I was more grateful for the 45 years she was among us, even though some of those years were quieted by mental illness and challenged by mental illness. I treasured those years. I was grateful for those years more than I grieved the by that time 6 or 8 months without her. I hope that remains the case, because in general, I think that gratitude is an easier lift than grievance is. I don't know. I'm just doing a day at a time, April, the same as I've done for a long time, because as certainly anybody in my line of work knows, life changes very quickly, very quickly.
Yeah. If you're just joining us today, my guest is writer Thomas Lynch. His new collection of poems is called Bone Rosary. And so this collection in which it feels like your daughter, it's It's in part dedicated to her, and it feels permeated by her presence in many ways. This collection of poems and other works kind of explodes on us in a torrent of words. The second poem in the collection is called simply A Death. I was wondering if I could ask you to read it for us.
Well, sure I will. That was actually a poem. I think that might be the first poem I ever published. And I sent it to Poetry Magazine because it sounded like a place for poems. And when John Frederick Nims, The Bed of Heaven to Him, took it, he was from Muskegon, Michigan, which is probably why he looked at the poem in the first place, because the Michigan address on the return envelope. Now that I think of it, this poem was written in response to the death in her 40s of a classmate of mine all through grade school and high school. A death. In the end, you want the clean dimensions of it mentioned. To know the thing adverbially, while asleep, after long illness, tragically, in a blaze, as you would the word of any local weather, where it gathered, when it got here, how it kept the traffic at a standstill, slowed the pace, closed the terminals. Lineage and issue, names and dates, the facts you gain most confidence in facing, histories and habitats and whereabouts. Speak of it if you speak of it at all in parts. The CVA or insufficiency or growth that grew indifferent to prayer and medication. Better a tidy science for a heart that stops than the round and witless horror of someone who one dry night in perfect humor ceases measurably to be.
Does that observation about how we are able to talk about death and process death in pieces and through, I don't know, a certain distance, does that still track for you?
Well, I think talking around the edges, we like to get a toe in the door and then a foot in the door before we walk right into the room where the horrendous vacancy abides. Does that make sense to you, April?
Yeah.
It's like, like, it is a mystery, isn't it? And that's why I've always, I must tell you that I've made a life study out of funerals and what's important and what's nonsense and what's, you know, what are the essentials and what are the accessories? What are the fundamental elements of a good funeral and what's just the doodads and, you know, like, and one of the things I've always said is essential to a good funeral is the corpse. The dead guy has to show up. There has to be this confrontation between the living and the dead for the, you know, and actually it is the living getting the dead where they need to go that gets the living where they need to be. It's this funny little commingling of purposes that it results in, I think, good grieving, good mourning. And I can tell you that I have always sensed that. I've seen it in the hundreds and thousands of families that I've served over the years. And I can tell you that getting my daughter home from her death on the other end of the country in California, getting her home to essentially let her go again, to get her into home ground again, was for me the greatest comfort, a real balm and tonic to be able to say I got that done safely and soundly and brought her home, you know, to lay her out among her people and let them weep and share their stories about her and pray and dance and shake a fist in the face of whomever's in charge here. I mean, people do that at funerals, but I think the idea of death is something, but the dead themselves are what we must deal with, you know?
Yeah. I'd like to ask you for one more reading, the poem titled Skating with Heather Grace. Will you share it with us?
This was in my first book of poems, and it was Gordon Lish who chose this as the title poem, and I had learned by then not to fight with anything that Gordon Lish said, and I was very glad of it. I think it might have been a burden in some ways for my daughter to have a poem named after her. And thank you for asking for me to read this.
Sure.
It comes from an experience every parent has of going to the roller rink or the skating rink with their children in grade school and watch how they go around and round in circles. Of course, I spent most of my time trying to count syllables and make rhymes in my brain box while my kids just wanted me to wave and smile, you know. And eventually, mm-hmm. if you watch what's right in front of you, the poems present themselves. Nonetheless, we spend a long time looking at our children's ears when they're trying to tell us something. We should be looking in their eyes and listening closely. But one of the reasons I wanted a book on the shelf years ago was so that my kids would understand my diversions and preoccupations. Skating with Heather Grace. Apart from the apparent values, there are lessons in the circular. Paradigms for history, time in a round world turning, love with another of your species. To watch my only daughter widening her circles is to ease headlong into the traffic of her upbringing. Until nearly four, she screamed at my absence, mourned my going out for any reason, cried at scoldings, agreed to common lies regarding thunder, Christmas, baby teeth. Last year, she started school without incident. This year, ballet and new math. Soon, I think my love will seem entirely deficient. Later, there's the hokey pokey and dim lights for the partner's dance. She finds a shaky 9-year-old to skate around in counterclockwise orbits, laughing. Is it more willingness than balance? Is letting go the thing that keeps her steady? I lean against the sideboard, sipping coffee. I keep a smile ready.
It's a little terrifying to hear someone like yourself, who's had such a long acquaintance with death and life's tragedies, to hear you writing some of the things that come up in this collection.
Was it Yeats that said that any studious mind should only consider sex and death? I remember when I read that, I was about 21, and I thought, well, that's good, because I'm very fond of sex. And the dead were everywhere, being the son of a funeral director, and soon a funeral director myself. So I thought, well, I've got those corners covered, you know. But stick with the subjects we know, and sex and death seem to be, you know, those are, you know, 101 and 102 of our humanity, I dare say.
Yeah. Are there things that are coming up in your writing these days that were not there before?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have found that the indignities of age have about them an underbelly of humor that I never imagined it. Oh, I just thought it was a sadness, but it turns out not to be.
No doubt. I hope I'm not reading too much into this collection, but it feels like there is some reckoning with what your journey has cost you. The time that you took to think things through for writing, and the places that took you. Does that journey still feel worth it to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what I would do if I couldn't write down, you know, what's going on, you know, in my internal life. I think that's what makes writers writers. I'm sure it's what makes musicians musicians. They learn to sing their prayers and their lamentations It is the true for painters, I'm sure. They make sense out of form and color or whatever it happens to be. I can't imagine, had I not had access to a form. For me, it's language. And had I not had that, had I not had the certainty that I've had, and I'm grateful for the 30 or 40 years of knowing that if I wrote it, I could probably get it on a shelf in a library someplace. So, you know, I'm a member of a fellowship that claims that the spiritual life is not a theory. You have to live it. And I think we are nearer our spiritual life when we are dipping into our arts, whatever they might be, and when we're sharing the arts of others. I think that puts us nearer the language, the countervalent language. I was reading a wonderful manuscript yesterday that'll soon be published by Wayne State University Press that uses that trope, countervalent language. And I think art gets us there, gets us into a different lexicon. And I'm grateful for it.
Hey, speaking of our spiritual lives, I wanted to get a word in about the title of this collection. You're Catholic, and there's a really great story in the introduction of this collection that sort of explains the title Bone Rosary. It refers to this rope of bones that you hung for your late lamented companion Bill the dog some years ago. But it was obvious that the choice of words, as always with you, was intentional. For a lot of us, the rosary can indicate penance. It can be a way that we pray for people, but it can also be an invitation to mindfulness, a form of meditation as we say these repeated prayers over and over. Which is it for you?
Well, I'm not sure. We always said the rosary when we were kids in May and again in October. And I always remember watching the nuns in grade school walk around with those long rosaries on their hips and watching the movement of the beads and the chains and thinking, I'd like to get to know her better. But these were all young women, and we were seventh and eighth graders, you know. And but I think prayer, like poetry, partakes of that countervalent language that Fleeta Brown, the wonderful essayist and poet in Traverse City, in her new book, writes about. Her book is called Mortality with Friends, and it's a collection of familiar essays on the topic of age and decrepitude and eventually mortality. But that language that poetry gives us access to, and prayer gives us access to, I think puts us in a better place. The theologian Tom Long, who's a friend of mine, wrote to me and said when he heard about my daughter's death, this pandemic keeps us from doing what we want to do, which is run to where you are and sit in silence before the mysteries. I just can't think of a better way to describe what it has been like for me going on a year maybe, that the comfort of sitting in silence before the mysteries without anybody saying, I need an answer to this, or this must add up to that, or, you know, what's the sum total of that or the square root of it. Just the mystery itself has, if we look at it, you know, without encumbrance, has in it a kind of balm and comfort to it, a mending, you know, What is it Leonard Cohen sings? Gather all the brokenness and bring it to me now. Yeah.
What form is your faith taking these days?
Well, I think I spend as much time laughing as weeping at the signs of a loving God that I sometimes discern, you know?
Boy, that's a lot of laughing and a lot of weeping.
Yeah, it is. I'm very Rumi-eyed, you know. I mean, the right movie, the right soundtrack to a movie will make me sit in the chair and weep until I fall asleep sometimes. But it's not the kind of huff and puff weeping. It's just that slow, I call it Rumi-eyed because it starts in the eyes. It always does. And it feels like settling, you know, settling in. You know, it's okay.
Well, Thomas Lynch, we really, really appreciate your being willing to talk to us about this stuff.
It's a little April like going to the shrink and not getting a bill for it, for people to ask you questions about yourself. So you can send me a bill. It'll be all right. You know.
Okay. Thomas Lynch's latest collection of poetry and nonfiction is called Bone Rosary. Thomas, be well, and we'll be thinking about you and your family.
Thanks so much, April. God bless.